This is KUNM. I'm Marisa DeMarco. You've heard of James Boyd, the homeless man who was killed by Albuquerque police last year. But you might not have heard of Len Fuentes. He, too, was mentally ill when he brandished a knife and was shot and killed by APD. Fuentes' mom says she had found mental health care for her son, but it was 3 days too late.
Albuquerque 911, where is your emergency?
It's my neighbors. I don't know what their apartment number is, but they've been screaming for like an hour.
This 911 tape was recorded on Monday night, July 26, 2010.
We have officers on the way. I just want to tell you.
Holy sh! Gunshots.
You just heard gunshots?
Hold on. Oh my God, but there's like three people screaming in the alley.
Police shot and killed Len Fuentes in Albuquerque that night. It was the ninth police shooting that year. Next on the tape are the harsh, raw cries of Fuentes' fiancée, Gwendolyn Dalton. Just hours later, she's interviewed by a detective.
I tried to run towards him, and the police grabbed me and put me on the ground and put their knee in my back. I was screaming for Len to look at me because I was on my stomach on the ground. I just wanted him to open his eyes and look at me because he was moaning.
Dalton says he'd been carrying around a steak knife in the waistband of his jeans.
Well, he's schizophrenic and bipolar with narcissistic tendencies. That's his diagnosis.
Police say he threatened them with a knife, and that's why they fired at him.
They had killed my son when they didn't have to.
Len's mother, Sylvia Fuentes, walks me around the apartments where he died. Think asphalt, dirt, chain link.
And then Len got away and he went back against this fence right here.
Sylvia didn't know Len was schizophrenic until he went to prison. That's where he was diagnosed, where a lot of people are diagnosed. Len had been on parole in Albuquerque for about a year, and Sylvia remembers that things were looking up. He was going to move back in with her in a few days.
And in 3 days was also going to be his first appointment with a psychiatrist. I had been trying to get one for him since he had gotten out of prison, and I never could.
It eats her up. This idea that she didn't get psychiatric health care figured out for Len in time. About half of the adults with severe mental illness in the United States, 3.9 million, are not receiving mental health care, according to the Treatment Advocacy Center. In the criminal justice system here, there's a shortage of treatment options, says John Madrid. He's a bail bondsman.
Case in point, I had a bond on Friday. The family wanted him out. I said, I will not bond him out until Monday, when his services kicked in.
A bondsman's primary job is to make sure people show up in court. Madrid is not trained to deal with mentally ill people, but he has a lot of experience doing it.
You know, the family said they would take care of him, but it was safer for the situation for me to wait till Monday. So once he's released, the family can take him directly to his inpatient facility that he needed to be at.
Inmates might see a psychiatrist while they're in jail or prison, get diagnosed, like Len Fuentes, and begin receiving care. But then they do their time, and they're released with a 30-day supply of their medications. Outside, maybe they can't find regular treatment, and so they come back again and again, returning to their de facto mental health facility in the back of a squad car. Each pass through the system, there's a chance for an altercation with police. Arthur Pepin is the director of the Bernalillo County Criminal Justice Review Commission. He says surveys show that, on average, there's a mental health component to the criminal activity of two-thirds of the people detained at the jail here.
What a lot of evidence shows is that if you deal with the mental health issue, you avoid the criminality. And, of course, that better serves the state in terms of how much money they're putting into the criminal justice system.
Pepin says the county has committed more than $1 million to transitional housing for mentally ill people, so they don't have to go to jail. And Republican Senator Sandra Rue has introduced legislation this session that would find alternatives for mentally ill inmates around the state. For KUNM, I'm Marisa DeMarco. This is KUNM. I'm Marisa DeMarco. Substance abuse treatment is not available for everyone who needs it in New Mexico, and this shortage is at the root of some tragic altercations with police. It's August. It's hot. Mike Gomez meets me in a park in Albuquerque holding a framed photo of his son, Alan.
He was a good kid, a normal kid. He graduated from high school on time. He was a Little League All-Star. Around mid-school, he started to have some emotional problems, and I wish I would have known it then as I did now. I guess he started drinking when he was about in the eighth grade. But he was still a happy kid, you know. He rode skateboards and stuff, and he was fearless.
By age 22, Alan was already a union sheet metal worker, like his dad, and he owned his own home. But Mike says his son was struggling with heroin addiction.
I was leaving town, and I wanted him to not be alone. I told him to go to his brother's house, and he did. I was proud of him. He was trying to get better, get straight.
That night in May 2011, Allen was shot and killed by police. A toxicology report found heroin and meth in his system, according to the district attorney's office.
His brother seen the whole thing, and his brother, right to this day, is still mentally just devastated, just eating on his soul.
Allen's brother's girlfriend called 911 that night. She told the dispatcher that Allen was acting crazy, was going in and out of the house, that he had a gun and wouldn't let them move.
I'm going to call the police department. Come out now!
This audio is from police lapel cam footage. Officers rushed into the house. Allen was shot in the torso and lay bleeding on the floor. You can hear the anguished cries of his brother in the background.
Ask her where the gun was.
Police officers didn't find a gun on or near Allen, but rather in the hall closet. In an interview with detectives, the shooter, Officer Sean Wallace, explained that he'd been on his way home after a shift when he heard about the situation on a police scanner. He turned his car around and headed to the scene. Wallace described seeing Allen's silhouette in the doorway of the house.
My mindset is that if he attempts to leave that doorway, I won't be able to react fast enough. We won't be able to get our hostage rescue plan in place fast enough before he kills the two people inside.
It was Wallace's third shooting on the job. Two of them were fatal, and all of the people he shot were unarmed. APD later came under criticism for not screening Wallace appropriately before he was hired. A DOJ report that found Albuquerque officers had a pattern of unconstitutional use of force mentions this case specifically. Quote, when the officer shot Gomez, the circumstances would not have suggested to a reasonable officer that there was an immediate threat. The report also said statements by police describing the night Allen was shot were inconsistent. The Gomez family sued APD, and the case was settled for $900,000.
National data tells us about 50% of those in jail and prison are clinically addicted.
That's Peter Bokert, coordinator of the state's drug court. It's a criminal justice track that requires addicts to get into heavily monitored treatment. He says you have to have a fully functioning behavioral health system for drug court to really work.
There are tremendous needs and gaps statewide that our behavioral health system is just unable to address. We have a lack of nurses and substance abuse care in many of our communities.
Mike Gomez agrees.
There's nowhere to hardly go in Albuquerque. Allen was 17 when he was starting to really do the heroin. He was losing weight, thought he was going to die. He had this little warrant out for his arrest for failure to appear for some traffic thing.
Mike hand-delivered his son's arrest warrant to police to make sure Allen would get picked up, because when Allen was in jail, he could get help with detoxing. Bokert says it's hard to know what could have prevented any one shooting case.
By the time they end up out on the street shouting at each other and guns getting drawn, we've missed opportunities further upstream.
Police shootings, Bokert says, are often the tragic conclusion to a series of failures. For KUNM, I'm Marisa DeMarco. This is KUNM. I'm Marisa DeMarco. When the Department of Justice report on the Albuquerque Police Department came out last year, it highlighted that interactions between officers and people with mental illness can be volatile. It also pointed to limited services. But what about the mental well-being of the officers?
Albuquerque Police, how may I help you?
Yeah, I want to report a suspicious person.
It's March 19th, 2012. This is not an emergency 911 call.
I was walking out to go to school. There's a guy sitting in a black Mitsubishi Montero, and he asked me if I knew anybody who wanted to buy a car system.
Officer Martin Smith responded, and within moments, shot and killed the man in the Mitsubishi SUV. Here's how Smith first tells the story. He pulled up behind the black SUV, got out, approached the vehicle alone, and began issuing orders for the driver to stick his hands out the window. 31-year-old Daniel Tillison backed up, hitting the police car. Smith shot a rear tire. Then he spotted a black object in one of Tillison's hands and shot him through the window. The object turned out to be a cell phone.
335 PD, shots fired. Subject tried running me over.
Subject tried running me over, Smith tells dispatch. He explains what happened next during an interview with detectives after the incident.
At that point, he didn't appear like he was breathing or anything. He was just, so I opened the door, pulled him out of the vehicle, laid him down on the ground, ran to the back of my car because I got a combat field dressings.
So Officer Smith is a veteran of the military who served in Afghanistan. The other people in the room check in with him.
You okay?
Yeah.
Good job. It's over. Yeah. Take a deep breath.
But the sticking point for Tillerson's family is this. Smith says Tillerson gave him a warrior stare.
He's looking at me the whole time, and he's like, I don't want to say like the warrior stare, where I'm going to hurt you type stare.
What officer is going to tell another officer that somebody gave them a warrior stare unless they were in PTSD mode? What is a warrior stare? How can you feel threatened by the way somebody looks at you?
Mary Job is the mother of Tillerson's three children. Job was with Tillerson for 10 years. In that time, she says he had a heroin addiction and went into methadone treatment. But she maintains he never brought his problems home with him. And when he was straight, she remembers, he was a caring and energetic dad.
Daniel sadly lost his life because of the officer and the mental status he had at the moment he had shot and killed Daniel. So my kids are now without a father because of the city's irresponsibility and negligence in hiring this officer.
That's the thrust of a lawsuit filed last year on behalf of Job and her kids. Frances Carpenter is Job's lawyer.
I think officers do have a really hard job out there. No one can disagree with that.
Carpenter alleges that Smith was diagnosed with PTSD by the VA hospital and that APD knew about it. Proof of that diagnosis hasn't been presented yet, and a judge will rule on that issue and others in the coming months. According to state regulation, police are required to undergo a mental health evaluation when they're hired, but some officers take a leave of absence to serve in the military.
When they come back, are they subject to a second mental health examination? No, they're not. Why aren't they?
APD explained in an email that those kinds of evaluations could be considered discriminatory under federal law. APD policy does require mental health check-ins and critical incident debriefings after traumatic events on the job. Still, Carpenter says the department isn't adequately screening officers or providing enough psychological care.
I think a lot of times these officers are themselves victims. They're victims of their employer. They're victims of a system that doesn't allow them to be people just like us.
Lieutenant Glenn St. Ange with APD's crisis intervention team says police are encouraged to report the misconduct of their colleagues. He appeared on the KUNM call-in show in November.
If it's, an issue of they're worried about the officer's having a tough time, maybe it's something at home, there's nothing punitive for an officer to make a referral.
But St. Ange adds, that process isn't always anonymous. For KUNM, I'm Marisa DeMarco.
Funding for KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Find out more online at publichealthnm.org.
This is KUNM. I'm Marisa DeMarco. KUNM's Public Health New Mexico Reporting Project has been investigating Albuquerque Police Department shooting deaths with an eye on behavioral health issues. I sat down with Paul Ilacqua, a former APD aviation officer. We talked about how police officers handle their own mental wellness in high-stress situations.
It seems like when you put that uniform on, you don't have a friend in the world. And it's really hard. And it's unfortunate, too, because a lot of times your only friends, or you feel like the only person that you can trust, is the person wearing the uniform next to you.
Do police officers kind of look out for each other's mental health and well-being?
Yeah, they do. And it's kind of an interesting culture because so many times you'll see something horrific on the news and you'll see police officers looking at each other laughing and giggling. Well, a lot of times they're doing that because that's their way of venting or getting it out. Probably, I would say, sometimes the officers are more in tune with each other than their own family members are with them. And they know their moods and their feelings.
Do you think it's true that police officers in general do a lot of interacting with mentally ill folks?
Every day. And in fact, I would say that the huge majority of the calls is either alcohol, substance abuse, or somebody that is ill, or what is known as dual diagnosed folks. Officers do have to deal with that on a daily basis.
Do you have any particular stories that kind of stand out from your time that you can relay?
Yeah, I do actually have quite a few stories, but a couple that stick out in my mind. I was a rookie and I was riding with a veteran officer. It was a 1040, a mental patient call. We show up an old trailer park in the southeast. And it was an elderly couple in their late 80s there with their mentally ill son who was unclean, unbathed, and you could tell he'd probably been off his meds for a while. And I'll never forget the fear in their eyes. I also remember officer I was with, he's retired now. There was a big knife, like a meat cutting knife, laying on the floor next to this guy's feet. And I can remember the veteran officer, the friend of mine, just very patient and talking in a very low voice. And I asked him later, I said, well, why were you talking so softly to the guy? And he says, well, he goes, if you think about it, the lower I talk, the more he's got to pay attention to me. So he is focusing all his attention onto my voice. And so later on in my career, I actually tried that, and I would be where somebody was talking, maybe not shouting, but very agitated, and I would bring my voice down and I would start talking lower, and it would bring them lower, and it actually works.
What is it like dealing with someone who's in an extreme moment of crisis, whether because of drugs or because of mental illness or both?
It can be tough, and it also can be rewarding. I always remember an instructor saying, life before property. And the biggest thing is trying to protect life. And that includes not only your own life, but the person that's in crisis, but everybody else's that's around you. And sometimes, depending where you're at and what the situation is, it can be very demanding. It can be a very tough thing because you have to make quick decisions on your feet right then and there, which can be life-taking or life-threatening, and you have a lot to worry about. Every situation's different, every person's different, and sometimes you have no idea what you're about to encounter.
That was Paul Ilacqua, an Albuquerque police officer for more than 7 years. For KUNM, I'm Marisa DeMarco.
Funding for KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Find out more online at publichealthnm.org.